Hello and welcome to Beyond the Back Page on New FM with myself, Patrick Donoghue. On the show today, I'll be joined by Leo Moynihan, author of a new book entitled The Three Kings, Busby, Shankly and Steen, The Makers of Modern Football. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Leo. Leo, thanks a million for joining us today.
Hello, Patrick.
So, first of all, Leo, what inspired you to write this book about these three legendary figures?
Well, that's quite a funny story. The book is going to be there's going to be a film to accompany the book.
Okay.
Which will be out in March. I was introduced to a filmmaker called Johnny Owen, who made a very good documentary on Ryan Clough's Nottingham Forest. And we got to talking. He's from South Wales. His father was a miner, a very proud miner, and would always pick out people in football who had worked underground. We got talking, and he wanted to make a film about these three incredible managers who all worked underground. And as we got talking, he said, you know what, you should write a book. You seem to know a bit about them and have a passion for them. And I dived in straight away. You couldn't stop me. So I was very pleased to do the book and learn more about these three incredible men.
And you mentioned the mining. Reading the book, I found it remarkable. All three men came within a 30-mile radius of each other. How big of an influence was that growing up in a mining village?
Well, they obviously didn't get to know each other until later, but it can't be a coincidence that so many football men actually of the time worked underground. I guess it was one or the other for a lot of communities. If you're good at football, it was your way out of life underground. The three of them, you can see in their football teams that they eventually managed, had something from underground, had something from their mining comrades. When you worked underground, you had to look after one another. Teamwork was everything, and not because a football match was at stake, but lives were at stake. And I think, on a very lighter note, with their football teams, all played in different styles. They all had different philosophies about the game, but they all played for one another. Teamwork was the key, and I think that came from their early start in life.
And what was interesting about their managerial career, I found, when you look at the likes of, say, Shankly and even Jock Steen, they served their apprentice. I'm thinking of Shankly. He was there at Grimsby. He was there at Huddersfield. So they really, really learned and worked their way up. Isn't that the case with them two in particular?
Absolutely. Shankly knew where he wanted to get to, but he kind of, I get the feeling he really enjoyed the journey to get there. And even when he was managing Workington Town and doing all the washing himself and changing light bulbs in little offices and Grimsby, Carlisle, he felt, being Bill Shankly, that he was bigger than the big managers at the time, the Stan Cullises, the Bill Nicholsons, and even Sir Matt, who he totally looked up to as a sort of father figure in a way, like most people did. But he enjoyed learning about the ins and outs of the game as a coach and football clubs and members of the board who could be tight and wouldn't sign checks. And Jock the same. Jock's journey into the game was very... He wasn't as talented a footballer as the other two. And moved to Celtic on a whim, really. Then he did a new reserve centre-half. And about a year and a half later, he was captain of Celtic and winning their first title for 10 years. But his coaching ability was there to see at Celtic with the young boys that he coached. All of them would become, well, most of them would become Lisbon Lions, a lot of them. But he wanted to be the number one. He wanted to be a manager of the club. But his Protestant background probably hindered him at Celtic at that point. He went off to Dunfermline and then Hibernian and just did wonders at these small clubs. You know, Dunfermline won the cup. He wasn't at Hibernian long, but he made them a big team. They beat Real Madrid in a friendly, which just a friendly, but you know, it was, they counted back then. And so Celtic had to have him. He knew the club, he knew the players that were coming through to the first team, he coached them, and he was going to be their man, and obviously changed Celtic forever, like all three men changed their clubs forever.
And how bad was, from doing your research, I found it very interesting with Jock Steen, the reluctance to give him that job. How bad was sectarianism in Scotland at that time?
I think it was bad. It was bad. You know, growing up where they grew up in Lanarkshire, Matt Busby was a Catholic. a practicing Catholic all his life. He didn't let the eke into his football career, but it was definitely a part of his life. He didn't go for the sectarianism side of it. And Jock was a Protestant, but detested all that. I think when Jock moved to Celtic as a player, he was struck by how people in the village he grew up in shunned him.
Mm.
He lost quite a few friends. One guy was over at his mum's when he came over, and he just walked out the house. And I think to Jock that was abhorrent. It wasn't anything to do with football. So why was it affecting how people thought of him? And as far as Jock getting the job, yes, there was a real Celtic. So the official line from Celtic was, "Let's let him go and manage other clubs before we give him the job because he can learn his trade." But Jock and Jock's wife weren't having that. They knew the truth at the time. The board weren't gonna give a Protestant the Celtic job then, and it was a problem. It was a big problem.
Mm.
Jock overcame it with the usual stoicism and hard mining humour, I guess. He was never going to let religion affect the game he loved so much.
Mm. And that on Jock Stein, just to wrap up on him, it is a remarkable achievement looking back. Him being the first British manager, first British club to win a European Cup, it really is an achievement. And you look back then, what they achieved, and considering all the players were born, the majority, was it just one player was born outside of a small radius?
10 miles, yeah. 10 miles out, I think, yeah, I mean, ridiculous.
Yeah,
yes.
It's an incredible achievement.
It's like a Celtic boys club winning the European Cup.
Yeah, it is an achievement. When you look at the way Scottish football is now, it is remarkable what he achieved with that team.
It's incredible, and I think it needs to be. To tell these three men's story again, we wanted to bring them to a younger audience who support these three massive, gigantic global institutions. But they were all on their knees when these three men joined them. They weren't in good places.
Mm.
And for Jock to take a team of local boys and play that Inter Milan team who had won the European Cup in 64, 65, they'd won the World Championship in both those years too, but full of superstars. Their coach was the most famous and renowned coach in the world, and Jock took them on without defending against them by taking the game to them. That's what pleased Jock the most. He took the game to them. He attacked them, and they were gone. Second half, Inter Milan are gone. I was lucky enough to watch the 90 minutes, and these are world class footballers on their knees with people like Jinky Johnson going round there, you know, taking on their Catenaccio style of defending that was just dismantled, really.
Mm.
And actually 2-1 really flatters Inter Milan. And Bill Shankly was in the dressing room afterwards. He was the only British manager who flew out there to see his friend. And he said, "John, you're immortal now." He used to call him John, like his parents did. "John, you're immortal now."
Mm.
And no truer words could be said, because what Jock and what all three are immortal at their clubs. They all have statues outside, but they've really...
Mm.
It's more than bronze. There's something very, very special about what these three men did for these three clubs.
Mm. And what I thought it was very interesting, and the friendship between the men. I was reading the passage in your book when you were talking about Shankly had he'd reluctance to getting from the chairman and the money men giving him money, and he was tempted to hand his resignation, but it was Busby that persuaded him. That seemed to be a real warm friendship that kind of lasts throughout their life.
Very much so. Yeah, Bill, for want of a better term, was a bit of a drama queen come the summer, and would often want to leave. I've done my bit. Maybe Bill's need for a pat on the back, maybe that was a bit of that. Maybe he did feel like he ignored his family too long, but he often wanted to leave.
Mm.
And it was a phone call from Matt every summer saying, "Why would you leave this club? You know, why? What else are you going to do with yourself?" And it was, I mean, Matt was totally right, because in the end, Bill was lost without football. But isn't it crazy to think of a Manchester United manager talking a Liverpool manager into keeping the job, and a successful one at that, a very successful one, who's who's basically going toe to toe with you for the top honours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I can't see Ole Gunnar Solskjaer talking Klopp out of resigning today.
Yeah, no, I did. When I was reading it, I was there. It's sad because there was a rivalry back then, but it wasn't. It's not as toxic as it is now. So it was nice reading that detail that there was that friendship and affection between even the players. You say they seem to get on well and socialise well together.
Yeah, I interviewed Paddy Quirin, the Manchester United and former Celtic man, for the book, and he made a strong point that, you know, if Liverpool weren't playing and United were, Shankly was at Old Trafford.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Law made the point that if United couldn't win anything, he wanted his old manager and mate Shankly to win something.
Mm.
They'd go out with their wives, they'd socialise, they'd go to shows and the cinema.
Mm.
I think Leeds United had quite a problem with, and the players
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
but absolutely, the players got on. The rivalry was on the pitch.
Mm.
They swapped titles between, I think, 63, 64, 65, 66, 67. Mm. It went back and forth.
Mm. Mm.
So there was a big rivalry. God, did they want to win games. But no, and on the towards the end of the mid to late 60s, you start hearing about bricks being thrown at maybe a coach window, or definitely use of some industrial language towards the likes of Dennis Laurie and Sir John from the terraces. But the toxic stuff started coming in the 70s. Mm. So it wasn't a thing for these three men, these three very close men. And they were all vying for the same thing, glory.
And we'd turn to Matt Busby. One of the most remarkable aspects of Matt Busby's career is recovering from that the Munich disaster in 1958. How close was Matt Busby to resigning in 1958?
Very, very close. I mean, resigning seems too light a word, I think.
He was heartbroken.
I mean, he said himself he didn't want to live. Those were his words.
Yeah,
he certainly didn't want to. I think he dreaded coming home and facing the families. Because, as I said before, Matt was a father figure to everyone, and his Busby babes were his babes.
Mm.
They were his boys. And he promised their parents that he'd look after them, nurture them, make them men. And he was doing that to a degree that, sadly, we'll never know. But he was distraught.
Mm.
He felt huge guilt. Football to him was secondary. He couldn't even contemplate building a new team.
Mm.
And it was in his hospital bed as he started to recover that his wife talked to him, and she gave him some stern words and said, "There are people you owe the club, you owe the city, you owe probably the families, the grieving families who don't want this to be the end of the team and the club." And for him to then 10 years, a decade exactly, and go on and win the European Cup a year after Jock Steen, another incredible story, and it's just another example of how their lives are entwined.
With Busby, was there a reluctance to break up? From reading your book, Shankly seemed to be better at breaking up the team and being a bit more ruthless. Was Busby, it's hard to talk of a fault with Busby given what he achieved, but was he a bit, should he have broken up that team a bit sooner after?
Well, I'd actually argue that Shankly took too long.
He readily
admitted it. Yeah, he kind of took too long. They loved their players.
Mm.
They absolutely loved their players. And all three kind of struggled. Jock maybe did it, but Jock did it too quickly.
Mm.
There were some of them still able to play well and at the highest level. But Sir Matt had a problem, yeah.
Mm.
I think after Wembley in 68, when he's won the European Cup, that's when he's finished, really, in his mind.
Mm.
The players even said he'd done it. I think he wanted to win that European Cup for the families of and the memories of the babes.
Mm.
They got to the semi-final the following year,
yeah.
Which, you know, it's good going. Yeah. But he'd gone, and then the team was kept on too long.
Mm.
He had the George Best issue,
trying to
salvage George from his own demons, I guess, and trying to get him on a football pitch was enough for any manager to take. No manager really had to cope with a George Best before.
Yeah.
So I think lots started to unravel. I mean, he came back and managed again, didn't he, once it went wrong for his successor. But yes, I think he definitely let things drag a little bit. Mm. So did Bill, but then Bill did it very sharply and quickly and did it well. Mm. Really just built another team. Mm. I mean, let's not forget Matt had built three teams before, you know, from the post-war to the Babes to the team that wins the European Cup. So he done his bit for sure.
Yeah, all three just remarkable, and your book brings it alive. And just going back to Munich, I found it one of the most arresting parts in the book was the detail when you're discussing when Matt Busby found out players were passed away. You were talking to his wife. He asked about certain names. He asked about Duncan Edwards. It's just incredible and well,
heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is, and well done in bringing that alive. It is remarkable. That detail, that's how he found out his
she was trying to protect him. He still wasn't a well man. He could hardly talk. It was, you know, he was on life support to an extent, but he needed to know. He knew something was up. He could see, there were priests coming in and out, and he knew something was up, and he needed to know because he was fearing the worst, which could it have got any worse. But he named name. He started to sort of murmur names that, bless her, she couldn't lie to him, and she'd shake her head. I mean, it brings a tear to the eye, doesn't it? To find out that his boys had gone, every death on that plane was an absolute tragedy. But when I'm sure Matt to hear Duncan had gone and Tommy Taylor and everyone, it's so sad.
Another detail I didn't know prior to reading your book was that Matt Busby approached Jock Stein with a view of him taking over Man United, and ultimately he decided against it. Did that sour their friendship, given that he...
I think like any long-term friendship, it was a little bump in the road. But Matt felt a bit let down. He'd given his word, but he'd made movements towards the job, Jock. Matt felt that he'd been used a little bit and that Jock was trying to get a new deal at Celtic, a club that he was too close to leave, even for a giant like Manchester United. And he went to the Celtic board and said, look, this has come up, and he got his deal. So, I mean, listen, it goes on a lot. But I think for Matt, it just felt like a little bit like him and Manchester United had been used, and that wasn't for him, really. But, I mean... They came round. They all three were so close, so alike, so much in common, so driven. It wasn't going to affect it long term.
And Shankly, I always find Shankly's last few years, they're really, really sad. He retired probably prematurely, and it just seemed that nothing after football seemed to fill that void in his life.
Yes. It's one of those, I'm not sure, I did a lot of research, I asked a lot of people, but the actual definitive reason for Bill going at a time when his team were purring, they demolished Newcastle United in the cup final, and it looked like they were ready to go for, to do what they did under Bob Paisley and win European Cups, something he so wanted to do. But he went, there's lots of theories, he went and he became quite lost. He carried on coming to training. All the players would call him boss. Bob Paisley was the new boss, and it started to affect results. The players admitted to me that they found it very confusing. Bob would be standing there, but they couldn't call Bill Shankly anything else but boss. And Bob, this very quiet, unassuming, wonderful lieutenant of Bill's, had to step in and say, look, of course you're always welcome at Melwood, but not the training ground, but not when we're working, because it's affecting things. And then Bill would go off to, I think he took it umbrage to it a little bit, and he'd go to Everton to train sometimes. And Bill couldn't pass a park with jumpers for goalposts and not stop and sort of observe and want to be involved. So football left a void that I think his family would admit really affected him. And Joe Fagan, another successor of his and one of his other lieutenants in the boot room, said he thinks Bill died of a broken heart, and Bill always had said he'll end up being the fittest man in the cemetery. He was so looked after himself, but he died of a heart attack, which was quite sudden. And maybe Joe Fagan had a point.
Yeah, and before I let you go, Leo, in the course of researching the book and discovering about these three remarkable men, does it make you kind of romantic about them days? Because it just seemed to me that, you know, football now has kind of lost a run of itself. Would it be nice? Was there a sort of you'd like maybe us to get back to them days in football?
You're absolutely right, Patrick. It made me smile about football men, real max on, know the game inside out. All they want to do is sit with a bottle of stout maybe and talk about the game and dissect the game and make their football team masters at the game. Mm. There was no, listen, they all had egos, they were three brilliant men, but there was none of them, there was no nastiness about each other. They could sit and have a drink, talk, a laugh. And you're absolutely right. It certainly makes me sort of nostalgic for this sort of pure, maybe purer form. Listen, the guys at the top of the game are absolute football geniuses. Klopp, Guardiola. Yeah. Look at the football their teams are creating. Yeah. But we all can always look back and see something we missed. But with these three men, their teams would be challenging today, no doubt about it, because the football they played is not something from the past. It was something of their present, but it was something forever. It was something for now. We talk about pressing and there's little, you know, the game in transition and all these little buzzwords. Shankly's Liverpool were pressing before, in the early 60s. Yeah. It was all about high energy, high up the field, get it moving, pass and move. Get at it. When you lose the ball, get it back quickly. And it got the cop going, you know. And all three teams had something special that would, which was found out today, and all three men would stand out today.
And a final question before I let you go. I know you're a Liverpool fan. Klopp seems to be a remarkable man, and he knows the history of Liverpool as well. Are Liverpool finally, it's looking good for them, are they finally going to win the title this year?
You won't lull me into making any predictions, but Klopp, Phil Thompson, the former Liverpool captain, told me a lovely story whilst helping me with the book, that he went to Melwood, the training ground, to interview Klopp last season. And he walked into Klopp's office and there's a lot of pictures of the past, you know. And there's a big picture of Shankly up there. Because he still thinks of Shanks as the boss, you know. And he's like, God, my old manager's up on his wall. And before the interview started, Klopp sat Phil Thompson down and said, tell me, what was it like to work with him? Why did he leave? Why did he leave a great team like that? And it was so, and it really affected Phil. You know, he was like, wow, this is the current manager of this super team that's about to become European champion. Yeah. And he wants to know about my boss and my time. So that tells you all about what the effect all three men have on the club. As I said before, that they are the domineering figures over their three clubs. Whatever success comes, Fergie was amazing at United, unprecedented success. But he'd be the first to say he was following a great man, you know, and Celtic became a global phenomenon because of Jock. I didn't answer really your question about Liverpool today, because I won't be drawn in it just in case, but Klopp's doing well and Shanks would be smiling.
Yeah, well, you can read a lot more about, we've just scratched the surface of them three remarkable men, Busby, Shankly and Steed. You can read a lot more about them in Leo's excellent new book, The Three Kings, The Makers of Modern Football. Listen, Leo, thanks a million for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me, Patrick. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. That was great. That was Leo Minahan, who was talking to us about his new book, Busby, Shankly, Steen, The Makers of Modern Football, which is available now. So over the next few weeks, we'll be focusing on some of my favourite books I've read over the last few weeks and even the last month or so, I guess, because I just thought with the Christmas period coming, it would be a good idea to feature interviews with people that have wrote some books to kind of give you maybe some idea for the presence for the sports lover in your life. That's pretty much it for this evening. I'd like to a sincere word of thanks to my guest today, Leo Minahan, who joined me to discuss his new book. Thank you for tuning in, and you can tune in next week for more sport. I'm hoping now, I'm not going to jinx it yet because I just have to get confirmation, but hopefully now I got some exciting news today regarding a potential guest for next week. So I will update you over the next few days on our Twitter and our Twitter page and social media channels. So stay tuned to that. It's a former Premier League player from the early days who, hopefully, I won't give too much away because I don't want to jinx it, because sometimes with them, these things, when you're dealing with people's representatives, you don't get the confirmation until you ring them, but or you've total confirmation. So hopefully next week we'll have a great guest, because I just coming up to Christmas, give you as much entertainment and more interesting sport coverage as possible. For more sport on Near FM, you can tune in to the Saturday Sports Show with Fergus Carroll. That's at 10:30 on Saturday. And Fergus will also have the Sunday Results Show on Sunday night. But that's it for this week. Thanks a million for tuning in, and I will talk to you at the same time next week.